Hi, everybody. It's Kate Langsdorf. I am the host of the Context Dramaturgy podcast, and I am very excited to have with me today Jacqueline Goldfinger, who I know. Jackie, I knew you before you knew me.
Really?
Yes, because I was the communications consultant for the National New Play Network. So one of my job duties was to internet stalk, for lack of a better word, the affiliated artists. And at the time, I believe you were, what do you call that? When you were the one of the featured playwrights. But I spent a lot of time cropping your headshot and putting it in newsletters.
Yes, for the NNPN's National New Play Showcase every December.
Yes. So 2015 was my big NNPN year.
Yay.
And it was a big NNPN year for you too. So, yeah, so I spent a lot of time with the concept of you that year before actually meeting you in person.
Well, thank you for putting all of the work into that, because I know the administration is hard.
Oh, it was a delight. And now the lovely Jess Hutchinson out of Chicago handles those duties, and I think she's just fabulous. So shout out to Jess Hutchinson. If you want to come on the show sometime, you should, because I like talking to you.
You should. She's great.
So you are a playwright. That's the main way. That's the first way that I knew you. But you're also a dramaturg, and so now I know you through Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas, where you, I think, are doing a fabulous job of spearheading all of our regional activities, making sure that happy hours happen. Because what is theater without a cocktail or its non-alcoholic equivalent in your hand?
If that was the platform I ran on at LMDA, if you vote for me for the board, we will quadruple the number of happy hours.
Yes. So
that was a vote getting platform, right?
Right. It's kind of, I find, all any of us really wants.
Yeah, I know.
To sit down and have a drink with other people who sort of share our woes. And spend some time lightly gossiping about the people who are terrible. I don't think that was in your platform, but that's the thing that I find the most valuable is, like, get a half a drink into people, and then they can be like, let me tell you what's really going on at my theater. That's my favorite part of LMDA.
Absolutely. It's between the lines.
Yes.
But yeah, it's those connections, and it's one of the things that I learned as a playwright, that both playwriting and dramaturgy tend to be more solitary occupations at times.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we're so much more powerful when we can get together and idea share. And that is always best done over alcohol, I have to say. No replacement for a good cocktail.
I think that's true. And I think what you said about it, those events being about what's between the lines is a lot of, like, what our work is too, is finding what's between the lines and trying to bring it to the surface. So I don't know if we're better suited to happy hours than other occupations.
I say yes. I think we go with that.
Tell me what you meant by that silence just then when I asked you how everything was going and you paused before you said it's very good.
I'm in the middle of a transition, which is incredibly exciting.
Ooh, I want to hear about it.
Yeah, so I finally left my day jobs for good. I've had day jobs for a very long time.
Ooh, I am proud of you.
I'm very excited. So now I'm playwriting and dramaturging full time, and I have a new newsletter called Page by Page, where playwrights can get every month, they can get an email with writing prompts and major deadlines and interviews with other playwrights about how they do their work.
How can I personally and our listeners sign up for that? Because I want it.
Page by Page on Patreon. It's great. And it's kind of like the virtual happy hour. It's like, yes, we're all in these little rooms trying to do our work. But often our work can be enhanced or improved if we learn from others. Mm-hmm. So this is a way for playwrights once a month to kind of stay in touch with each other and figure out perhaps better ways to do things that will make them more successful. And also get some writing inspiration. So I'm very excited to be the freelance lifestyle. And one of the things that I've noticed being freelance is that everyone has plays that they need read and developed.
Yes.
Like everyone. As
Yes.
soon as I left my day job, my email inbox filled up with like 30 plays from
Really?
friends and colleagues who were like, "Well, now that you have time, will you read this and give me feedback?" And I'm like, "I would love to read this and give you feedback, but I don't have the resources to do that on my own because I'm not independently wealthy."
Right. Like, I'm happy to be th I'm happy to do that in exchange for money.
Exactly. But one of the things that has one of the ideas that has been reiterated to me over and over by these playwrights who are emailing me, and now that I can be out in the community more and talk to playwrights, is that we have, and especially in professional and Lort theaters, locked in the idea of what new play development is. You know, you go for a day and you get 6 hours to hear actors read your work and to give them feedback, and then you throw it up in front of an audience in a reading that night. That's a popular developmental model. Another is the, 10 or 12 hours over 3 or 4 days, and then you put it up in front of an audience. So all these reading series and all these workshop programs, which have the best of intentions and have had some incredible outcomes, but now as theater, especially the pioneering edge of theater, is pushing more towards interdisciplinary work, installation work, playing more with being more playful with language, being more playful with form, that those same structures that we've created for developing new work don't always suit the needs of the work that's being developed. So one of the things that I find exciting is like thinking about what are the next new models for new play development, given where theater's going artistically, and that's really exciting.
I want to come back to that. So you have you've had a little what strikes me as a recent victory is that I've seen pictures of one of your plays just out on shelves out in the world.
Yes.
Can you so that's Bottlefly, right? Is the one that is
Yes, it was
getting
commercially
bitten.
published
That's
by Yale
great.
Press, which I'm incredibly excited by because we don't do much commercial publication of plays in the
Right.
US. So it can be hard to get new plays. But there are a couple of publishers here in the US, including Yale Press, that are smaller publishers that want to get more plays to the people through reading them as well as seeing them.
I personally love that model because for me, reading a script is, just because of the nature of the work that I do, that's where I do my the bulk of my theatrical engagement is with the script before it ever hits the stage. So I enjoy that, but I'm curious about with Bottlefly, what was the play development process for that?
So Bottlefly is a little different. I developed a play, and I developed a play at the Playpen New Play Conference in Philadelphia,
That's
which was
right.
fantastic. It's a summer new play conference where you get 3 weeks in a room with a director. The playwright gets 3 weeks in a room with a director and cast. So, it's phenomenal because you actually have time to implement real changes, see how they work, and then go back and revise again, which often is not an opportunity you get because you're usually limited to 10 or 12 hours.
Right.
So I developed it there. I did a revision at the Yaddo Artist Colony, which is more about the writing. They don't provide collaborators, but it's great to have a quiet, taken care of place to write. And then it won the Yale Drama Prize, which is a prize anyone can apply for. It's an open admission prize. They had 1,700 submissions this year from around the world because they,
Whoa.
I was just at Lincoln Center for this year's ceremony. And they're huge because they take English language scripts from around the world. So then once I won the prize, one of the benefits was Yale Press saw the play and wanted to pick it up for commercial publication. And again, there are only a couple of commercial publishers doing plays. Grove Atlantic is another one. They're about to publish Antoinette Nwandu's Passover for anyone who wants to pick that up in their bookstore soon. But it's I did revise the play again for the version that went into bookstores, and I added description, knowing that it was going to be readers who may or may not have the visual literacy of the
Oh,
stage
that is
that
interesting
I
and
was used
smart.
to.
Yeah, so when you wrote it initially, were your stage directions fairly sparse?
Yes. They were, because that's what we do in theater typically, not always,
Right.
but often, because we are schooled, whether formally or not, but as a theater artist and performer, you're schooled in understanding what fills the gap between the words, or figuring out what should fill the gap between the words. That's not typically a skill that most people have automatically. So, Bottlefly has been incredibly successful with readers, and I think part of it is because we did go ahead and give them some more narrative rungs on the ladder so they could climb with us and go on that journey with us and not be left behind. And so I would love to see more commercial publication of plays, especially because our country is so huge. So the fact is there's so much phenomenal work going on, and you're just physically not going to be able to get to all of it.
For sure. Yeah, some of my favorite plays are ones that I sort of have imagined the production of in my mind because I've had access to the script, but maybe not necessarily to an actual production. And I know every musical theater nerd kid has got that same sort of feeling with like, I have the soundtrack, and boy, do I know all the words to everything in Les Miserables. Never seen it, but boy, I know it's my favorite. I think it's a little bit of the same thing. And I think that that is good. I mean, I would love it if everybody got to see everything, but it's useful for us to just have access to the stories.
Absolutely. And that's the starting point for a lot of us. And I think that we need to look at the way that we publish scripts, whether they be the commercial run, or I wish honestly the acting editions, although that's another conversation because that's a different type of publication. But with the rea with the realization that these are going to be read by people who may or may not have access to the vocabulary of theater, so how do we make these stories more accessible to the readers? And I mean, I grew up in the rural South, and we did not have professional theater, so the only way I had access to theater until late in high school was through reading it.
Oh, where did you
And
grow
you
up?
look, I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay, I have been thinking of you, entirely as a Philadelphia person, and then I just had this funny little like brain flutter right before we started, where I was like, "Where is Jackie? She's in Appalachia, right?" And I'm like, "That's no, she's very much in Philadelphia." But something in my subconscious knew that you were like a Southerner deep in your heart. So Tallahassee, not a big regional theater scene going on there.
Not so much.
And so you got
And what I
into it with your
realized,
scripts.
I did. And so I got in it through literature rather than through performance. And I love performance. But the reality is everyone can't access it. So when I was having Bottlefly published with Yale Press, and I had a chance to revise the manuscript specifically for their publication, I thought back to what made the plays that I grew up reading good reads so that I could fully understand them, or at least mostly understand them without needing to see them staged.
And what did you come to?
And what I came to was that I did flesh out the stage directions. I did like a little bit of a Tennessee Williams approach to the stage directions, where they very much picked up the feel and rhythms of the dialogue, but were more expository and gave a little more sense of what emotional turmoil the non-speaking characters were going through. And I think that that's one of the reasons it's become such a popular read. And I think that we need to think, if we're going to expand the ideas and influences and sharing stories of theater, That's something we need to think about, is what makes those early plays such good reads. And you can always have different versions. You can have the commercial version that's on the bookstore shelves, and then the acting version that's with the theatrical publishers. Like, there's no reason all those versions need to be the same, per se.
That's true, and it's very, it's something I hadn't given a lot of thought to, about what goes into the commercial texts. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, because those were so much more accessible as a young reader, like just going to Barnes and Noble and seeing like, well, there are 20 things to choose from, so what am I reading today?
Yeah.
So it sounds like Bottlefly, from a new play development perspective, correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't a performance-based development. It doesn't sound like at all. Like, it's been pretty much words on the page.
Yes. And that's so, and for Bottlefly, that worked, because it is a very through written script. Every character's story has an arc. It has a beginning, middle, and end. They are very explicit about the conflict. So having a play that was more lightly developed worked. Worked fine. I would say that it's tougher to develop scripts like my upcoming play, Click. That like Click is experimental in form, and it jumps time periods, and it requires bodies on stage to know whether or not the story is going to make sense in the way that I think it will. Because a lot of the story is told not by dialogue, but by specific bodies in space. So like for Click, I was very lucky to have a development opportunity with Emerson Stage in Boston, which is at Arts Emerson, where you actually go in and you get to work with their company for 3 months every weekend. And literally just try anything you want with actual actors and designers in the physical space, and you're passing ideas back and forth. That process at Emerson Stage and the Arts Emerson space was crucial, because I couldn't rely on the dialogue to tell the bulk of the story for me.
That makes sense.
So that's what I'm talking about in terms of us diversifying our new work processes. Emerson Stage is on the forefront of that. University of the Arts, pairing with professionals, is on the forefront of that. Ground Floor at Berkeley Rep is on the front floor of the forefront of that. There are places you can go that are much more flexible in terms of what they can offer, and they let you form your own process for plays that need it. And I think that's really exciting.
So you alluded to something earlier about not being independently wealthy, which is a shame.
I just played that billion lottery and I did not win.
It wasn't your big day.
So now I have to sell my children.
Oh, dang it. I hate it when I have to sell my children. I think that that's important to discuss a little bit is making space to take time off of, you know, a day job when you had one, and, you know, if you don't sell your children, arranging for childcare and all that. Do you find that these development opportunities, even though they're going to get you to a work that's publishable, do you find them prohibitive to engage in as a non-independently wealthy person?
It's incredibly difficult. I'm very grateful that I am in the generation of artists that is supported by organizations like the Sustainability Foundation and the Parent Artist Advocacy League that are constantly pushing for making sure parents in the arts are supported. Mm-hmm. So those initiatives are new within the past couple of years, but I think we're lucky to have them. It's incredibly hard, and I'm very lucky that I have a partner who has a full-time job.
Right.
And so that is, that, like, at least the rent will get paid.
I love paying the rent.
yeah, I know. You know, one of those things. And I'm very lucky, frankly, that I have parents who, while they don't live near us, visit once or twice a year, and usually I schedule my workshop times during the times they're visiting.
Oh,
because
I like
they
that.
Watch the kids, and then I can go somewhere for a week and do something. So I feel like even though it can be very challenging and I've had to turn things down, that I am luckier than a lot of people in our community who have to leave when they have kids.
Yeah.
Because it's just not financially sustainable unless you have significant support.
And have you found, this is something that I found mostly as a new mom, and I'm not that I'm un-new, but my son Charlie is 5. So I think that if our kids got together, they'd enjoy playing with each other. But particularly when he was a baby, I found that there was an assumption that I couldn't participate in the field. And I saw doors kind of closing just almost because it was like, well, no one wanted to bother me. Which in some ways as a brand new mom, I was very appreciative of the intent behind that. Like, she's got a lot on her plate, let's leave her alone. But also like, oh no, I wanted to go to that thing. It's very hard to be home with this baby all the time. I would have loved a weekend away to work on my art. And I think have been a little bit more conscious of the ways in which parenthood has affected your art, at least in the ways that I've seen you talk about it or engage or approach the subject on social media. What have you found about doors that are closed that you are not necessarily closing or opening that you have not necessarily been the one to open since you became a parent as well as an artist?
Well, it was very telling for me that one of my artistic director friends, who is very honest, and that is one of the reasons that I love him, told me when I first got pregnant to hide it as long as I could from people in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was incredibly, incredibly telling. It is like when you have someone who wants you to work and wants to work with you, say, we're not going to tell any of these funders or any of these co-producers that you're pregnant.
Like, oh.
Because they will make assumptions about what you are capable of doing. Mm-hmm. That's really telling. And I've definitely had people who, when I'm in interviews for things and they know I have kids, because I actually feel, so I did hide my pregnancy for a while, which I'm like, I wish I would have done that differently and better. But after I had kids, I'm like, look, this should not be a shameful thing.
Right. You're this shameful, shameful weird. Family.
That's right. I think I'm going about this all fucking wrong. So I readjusted. And so one of the things you see on social media is I'm very open about both, here's my life as an artist and I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do both. And sometimes it's really hard. And sometimes when your kids see your words spoken on stage by an actor for the first time, it's totally awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my daughter is very proud. So I, like you, I have 5-year-old kids, but I have twins. And my daughter is like, my mom's a playwright. She makes people say things.
It's the biggest boss of all. You put words in people's mouths and then they have to say them whether they want to or not.
That's right. So it's fantastic, but there was definitely a growth for me personally of being like, okay, how do I put this out in the community? And every once in a while, it still comes up because I'm so public about the kids.
Right.
I was on a finalist for a fellowship, and they were like, well, you would have to be away from home for 2 months one summer. Like, what about the kids? And I'm like, I appreciate that you care about the well-being of my family, but I can care about the well-being of my family.
Right.
And I will take care of it.
Oh, man.
I did not set them on fire, which was my first instinct.
Oh, that was really nice of you.
I thought so, too. But it is so, but as I said, I feel incredibly lucky that we have a couple of organizations now working to make this not a shameful secret. Like, having a family should not be a shameful secret.
Deep-seated shame of my lovely son and all of his charms.
Right. And I also think, you know, stepping back, looking at what we have done to ourselves in the theater community by not paying living wages for the most part, by not providing support. And then you say, well, of course we're no longer a major part of culture, of pop culture anymore, because we have disengaged the artist from some of the most important moments and the most important experiences in contemporary life.
Yes. Oh, you are singing my song.
So if they don't connect with those, and you know what they are, if they want to, I'm not saying everyone has to have a family or everyone has to live anyway, particular way.
But if you want to, that should be an option.
Right. And I think that there are a number of ways that, because of how our systems work in theater, we have pushed artists to actually disengage with their communities rather than engage. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant reason and why theater is no longer a part of pop culture. We're seeing audience decline, all of this because we forced people to not have experiences that would inform and help them connect with their communities.
This dovetails with one of the stats that I found most interesting in all of theater data, which I think came out of the 2014 Culture Track study from LaPlaca Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about, they did, you know, a deep dive of research into what makes people participate in culture. One of the things they found was that people were now defining culture much more broadly than they had before, because it used to be like attending the fancy arts is culture. But as of 2014, it also included watching Masterpiece on PBS, and visiting a state park, you know, basically doing anything that was, you know, that I would count as like engaging with the culture around us. It was a little bit more pop culture, a little bit more community based.
Sure.
And the number one reason that people chose to do any of these activities was to spend time with whoever the person was they were bringing with them, whether it was going on a date, whether it was going out with their family. But it came down to, I want to engage in my community, so I'm going to go do this thing outside of my house or inside my house, so in the case of Downton Abbey. But I'll bring someone over and we'll have cocktails.
Yes.
And
it always comes back to the cocktail.
It always comes back.
It's
even
amazing.
The best state park trips, guys, you put it in the red Solo cup. If anybody asks, it's just punch. There are a lot of drinkers in the theater. We have reason.
Yeah, but I find it so interesting. So I'm glad you cited that survey, because I found it so interesting, because for me as an artist, the theater is a place of connection. Like, it's a place I want to take people I love and see something together in real time as live people, and then talk about it.
And then talk about it.
And like, that's the rest of the evening is like cocktails and thrown punches sometimes, you know?
Yes.
So I think that what's interesting is that we have, like, it's another form of disengagement, right? To go to the theater is that we've disengaged our artists from their communities by not allowing them to live as full lives as they often want to. And we've disengaged the art from the active community. And that's why there's actually now Dominique Morisseau creates, in all of her programs, she has a guide for audience participation.
I didn't know that. I love her. I mostly know her as an essayist from that American Theater article that she wrote a few years ago, just about not feeling welcome in Broadway
yes.
houses, because she's an African American woman, and I'm a person with a cane, and so I get a variation of that. Her article inspired me to write a series of articles for HowlRound, basically about the side eye that I get as a disabled person in theater.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Kate.
It's fine, because I'm coming at it with an awareness and like I'm gonna hit you all with my cane now kind of vigor with it.
Yeah.
But it's disappointing, but it's also instructive because I'm looking at these data sets, and looking at, the expertise that I have and the experience of the actual artists, and it's just like, I just want to like clap my hands and be like, let's get it together, people. Like, here is the path forward. Everybody get your shit together and let's just go make some good art. Anyway.
Absolutely. And so, and part of that art is the community, is the audience that comes to see it. And
Yes.
so, and Morisseau's fantastic announcement or flyer, I'm not sure what they call it, manifesto that they put in the programs for her shows, it says, you are allowed to laugh.
Yes.
You are allowed to cry. You should engage with this process. We ask you to wait to engage with your neighbor until after the show, just because they are going to be having their own engagement experience. But it is an encouragement to engage. And if anyone wants to look it up, if you just Google Dominique Morisseau, probably manifesto or program insert, it'll come up because it's become very popular.
I'm gonna put it in our show notes for this episode.
Great. And it's and there are communities, the art church in West Philadelphia just created their own. So people are using that example as a jumping off point to create notes in their own programs and post it on the walls of their theaters, outside auditoriums, so that people know that yes, this is a place where you should engage. We are not, we want to do that more.
I'd like to
Because
take a,
people are clearly yearning for it.
I, absolutely. And I want to take just a small technical pause. Hi, listeners. You might hear some background noise. If you'd like to support the context by going to, what are we, like patreon.com/thecontextpod. Anyway, if you hear all that clacking around, we could fix that with money. Just like with everything in the arts, we could fix it with money. But we're experimenting with our software and our hardware and all those things. So I'm picking up some background noise from you. It sounds like a thermos and a windstorm.
Oh
But it's okay. And I don't even know what people are going to pick up on my end. We never know till we get to post. It's always something fascinating.
no. Well, I will say in a couple of minutes, my kids will come out of school, so then you're going to get a lot of screaming.
I'm excited. You're on East Coast time. My child does not come home from school until a little bit later. But the screaming 5-year-olds are welcome to be the thing that closes our podcast out. I
Yes.
will not force them into hiding.
Oh no, I'm taking six of them home with me today. There would be no hiding.
Holy cow,
There'd
that's
be
so
no
many
hiding.
kids.
Yeah, Fridays are big. I take the kids home from our street so that parents can. It's good. We have a parent share. Sorry, this is nothing you need to know
That's
about.
great. No, actually, that brings me back to a question I had wanted to ask you earlier about, being a parent artist and being away from your family, was if you have like a parent artist community, like if you do any of that, like nanny sharing, like rotational, I'll watch your kids while you write the thing. I keep hearing about this. It sounds lovely, but I personally am a little bit introverted, except for on the internet. And so I'm not like, I don't know how to just like go out and make f artist friends and be like, let's watch each other's kids while we get work done. So I was wondering if you had that kind of support in Philadelphia.
Well, I'm lucky. They're not all artists. But I do have, like in our neighborhood, we have a number of stay-at-home parents, dads and moms. And so we have, and we all go to the same elementary school. So
Oh,
we've
great.
organized and like just a little cooperative where Wednesday, one of the dads picks all the kids up, Thursday, one of the moms, Friday, I do it. And then usually Friday afternoon, coming back to cocktails, which is always the best subject. Friday afternoon, I usually have some wine out and someone brings some beer and we have a little Friday afternoon happy hour while the kids play. So, I mean, I think that type of community, artistic or otherwise, is invaluable just so that we can have lives as grown-ups, whether they
Right.
be artists or not. And that's so important. One of the things I've noticed is that kids whose parents don't have their own lives and are unhappy. The kids are more unhappy. I think it's really important.
Yeah, that's That's
for
something
our
that
kids that we have our own thing.
I've thought about that a lot as a mother, particularly as a mother in the theater, where, when I had Charlie, my day job, it was like a it was a very good Lord theater job, but even a very good Lord theater job doesn't really pay enough to support having a family. And trying to weigh like, okay, the cost of daycare versus the cost of going to work. But at the end of the day, like I wanted to be able to demonstrate that I have things that I care about, that I'm engaged in the community, and that I wanted to model liking my work for my child versus I look at my not to get too therapy session-y, but I look at my own mother who really did throw herself entirely into motherhood. And then when we grew up, she was just like, okay, now what do I do? And she's still sort of figuring that out. And it's, like I wish she'd had something else to be interested in, for mine and my siblings' sake as well as for her sake.
Yes, I wish all parents would sit down and watch Bad Moms and Bad Moms Christmas, because those two movies encapsulate what happens to grown-ups when we don't have our own lives.
Oh,
It's
I think I have
great.
that on a streaming service, and me and Andy, my husband, have been. It's one of those things on our long to-do list of things after Charlie goes to bed, that we never get to. So I'm gonna put
Oh my God, they're hysterical.
Bad Moms.
They're on Amazon or Netflix. I can't remember which one, but yeah. And they outline, and they're really funny and they're fun to watch. But they also outline like what happens both to parents and then to grandparents when they don't have lives other than the kids, and it is bleak.
It is absolutely bleak. And I most of my like besties are high performing, like high achiever ladies. And the talking about this dynamic, especially in LA where we are, there's a lot of wealth. I don't have any of it. I want some. If anybody wants to give me some, I'll take it. But there is this dynamic of moms who are either super high achievers and as engaged in their kids' lives as they can be, and the stay at home, not getting out of my yoga pants ever, which just sounds wonderful. I mean, no shame in that game. But there also seems to be this sort of animosity between the various tribes of. Like mommy wars. I think that's mommy wars. I think that's what that concept is
Absolutely.
yeah.
And it's also, I think, like it's the bigger problem of women have always been set up against each other, that like, so we have internalized that that those behaviors of
Right.
turning against other women, because that's the easiest and least threatening thing to do, to get out of our aggression and anger or being unhappy. And that has culminated in these mommy wars, which is ridiculous. But very real. And it's interesting being the artist in the middle of the mommy wars, because you're always busy, but it doesn't make money. So
Yes. Oh.
people are like, why are you just wasting your life and your child's life by doing this thing that has no value? Because in a capitalist society, we see money equaling value.
Yes, I'm so
And
bad at
so
capitalism.
I know, I'm so that's gonna be my gravestone, Kate. I'm so bad at capitalism. But really, what we're, I think, teaching them is that there is a qualitative as well as a quantitative value to their lives, and that's always going to be a balance. So I think it can be really good for kids to see these things, but we should also be talking to our children about why am I gone so much, and what does that mean, and where am I, and how do I interact with you, and all of that as an artist.
Are your children, because I know you're at home on a weekday as I am working, but at home, I have an inconsistency in my schedule. Are your children at a phase where every time you're like, I have to go to the theater, they're like, don't leave me. I will miss you so much. I'll be lonely for you. What does the theater have that I don't have? Or is that
Oh, that's
unique to
so
me?
sad. I'm so sorry that you're experiencing that.
You've got twins, so they could be like, peace out. We've got plenty of activities that we could do on our own. Thank you.
Well, what I try and do is I try and make them a part of every process, at least every process that is in our city. So they've even if they don't see shows at theaters because those theaters only do adult shows, they come in and they see the set and they meet the costumer because my kids love costumes.
Oh, that's
And
great.
so when I go to work, to theaters to work, they know what I'm going to do, and it's not this weird thing that's taking me away. It's something that they know a little bit about, and that when they're old enough, they can go too.
Yeah.
So I've tried to make it as friendly and as part of our lives as we can, so it was not the scary thing. We still have some tears occasionally, but usually, and now when I travel, my son knows I'll bring him back a toy. So he's like, "Can you travel more?"
Can you please get
But I do think there are ways that we can integrate our theatrical lives with our family lives that we don't necessarily do on a broad spectrum right now, but we really could do more of. And that's also a testament to the fact that in Philadelphia, we have a lot of artists with families. Many artists who've moved from more expensive cities to Philadelphia to pursue their art, because we're a less expensive city, but we have a deep cultural base.
Man, that has been a recurring theme on this podcast and just with my conversations with other artists generally. It's a lot of like, well, I'm here right now, but I'm looking at Philadelphia because I've got a baby on the way or because I would like to pay my rent.
Exactly. So like when you say to someone like Blanca, who heads the Wilma Theater, or Kevin, who heads Azuka, or Allison, who heads Simpatico, like when you ask any of them, it's like, can I bring my kids in so they can see what we're doing a little bit, 20 or 30 minutes before rehearsal on the first day? They are all into it because they either have families or they're a part of families in a very integrated way. And one of the reasons a lot of artists move here, not just theater, but we have a thriving film community, a fiction community, visual arts, is because it's a more family-friendly city. So I feel lucky that we ended up here.
Yeah, that's great. And you guys have a great museum scene too. I actually talked about this with Sally Olive on the last podcast I recorded, because she's from Philadelphia and has moved to Seattle. And so I also have a background in museum interpretation, which is basically dramaturgy for museums.
So cool.
And when I was looking at, where can I move, some other data report that came out is like, a map of all the museum jobs or all the museums in the United States. Washington, D.C. had the most at, I think, 103 museums, and that's where I lived at the time. Like, great, I'm in the right spot. And then Philadelphia was number two. I think it had 95 museums, and the jobs pay the same pretty much across the board, but then it's Philadelphia rent instead of Washington, D.C. rent. And that,
Oh my
though,
God, yes.
you've only, you personally and your city has always been in the back of my mind. Like, if I want to go get a good museum interpretation job where I can pay the bills.
Oh my God, you should come here. We would have so much fun. There would be so many cocktails, Kate. There would be so many cocktails.
Oh, I'm gonna think about it. 'Cause I'm on the prowl career-wise, as I think a lot of us kind of always are as artists. But I'm gonna look
Well, good. Well, artists and artists with families are always welcome in Philly.
Oh, that's nice. Get a job with the city if you want. They should be paying you to be the
I'm a fan. But
cheerleader.
before we close up, I know we have to close up soon, but before we end, do you mind if I do a shout out to my website? Is that
Please
okay?
shout out everything that you want to promote, and I'll get it all in the show notes. But I think everybody should buy your wares, give you money, use your consulting services, and go have drinks with you in Philadelphia.
I love it. Well, I've tried to consolidate everything. So it's all on my website, which is jacquelinegoldfinger.com. JacquelineGoldfinger.com. You can sign up for our monthly newsletter service that gives you tips and tricks and insight. You can buy my plays. All those things are linked to on my site. I hope folks will check that out. And if you're in Philly, give me a shout out and we'll have drinks because we love to do that here.
I love it. Jacqueline, thank you so much for being on the show with me. I'm so glad that you were willing to get into bees that were in my bonnet as well. And I, in addition to talking about, you might be my fanciest playwright friend, like person who I actually have a relationship with. You might be my fanciest artist friend. I'm gonna think about it, but not too hard, because I don't wanna like rank and dethrone friends. But
No, I'm just happy to be your friend at all.
oh,
Okay,
that's so
anytime.
nice.
Thank you for having me on your show.
All right, go have fun with the kids. Thanks for bringing your wisdom to the context, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Context Podcast. You can learn more about our guest and the topics we covered today by heading to thecontextpod.com. That's thecontextpod.com for exclusive bonus content, including monthly episodes and secret Spotify playlists and some other cool stuff. Become a subscriber by going to patreon.com/thecontextpod. You can also follow along with our adventures on Twitter, where we are at ContextPod, and you can email us all your questions and episode ideas and thoughts and other things, just no dick pics, at thecontextpod@gmail.com. This episode of The Context was made possible by the 2018 Dramaturgy-Driven Grant from the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. Learn more about membership and how you could maybe get a grant for doing a thing you like at lmda.org/join. They don't require me to thank them, but it's a good group of folks, and I'm glad to be involved. They also don't require me to tell you that everything said on this podcast is my own opinion and not necessarily the views of LMDA, but that's also true. I don't think that LMDA would put dick pics in their closing bumper as a phrase to say. Anyway, that's all on me, not on them. Thanks for joining us.